Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon in for Roland Martin. Just ahead on News One Now, the Chicago Police received new recommendations for reform from its appointed task force. We'll discuss. As former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders prepare to battle it out at tonight's debate in New York, the two are still trying to woo black voters by speaking at the National Action Networks Conference. We'll have highlights from Secretary Clinton's speech. North Carolina's governor is hoping his executive order will ease the backlash to the state's bathroom bill. But is it enough to stop the protests and bring back business? Cedric the Entertainer shares personal stories behind bringing awareness to diabetic nerve pain. Roland discusses the political footprint and past of the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas with actor Wendell Pierce in part two of their sit down. And we have a recap, all the NBA action from last night. News One Now starts right now. The Chicago Police Accountability Task Force has released a scathing report on the Chicago Police Department. The report, entitled Recommendations for Reform, Restoring Trust Between the Chicago Police and the Communities They Serve, highlights the fact that the Chicago Police Department's own data gives validity to the belief that police have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color. For example, from 2008 to 2015, though African Americans are only a third of the population in Chicago, 74% of the people killed or shot by officers were black. Meanwhile, only 14% of shooting victims were Hispanic and only 8% were white. During the same time frame, police in Chicago also disproportionately used tasers against African Americans as well. 76% were black, 13% were Hispanic, while only 8% were white. But the point of the report was to actually develop recommendations on how to improve the police department. With over 100 recommendations to improve the police department, here are a few. Create an inspector general for public safety. Expand the body cam pilot program. Establish a deputy chief of diversity and inclusion. Create a community safety oversight board. Evaluate and improve the training officers receive with respect to youth. Joining me on the panel today to discuss this are Ralph Chittums of the Republican Party, Michelle Bernard, political analyst and attorney with the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy, and David Swerdlick, assistant editor at the Washington Post. So, to you all, is this report, does it really cover and make the types of substantive recommendations that are going to be necessary to improve or increase the public's faith in their police department?
Well, the report is just a piece of paper. The question is anything actually going to be done subsequent to this report? Now, you've had, you know, the Foxes now policing the Foxes, writing a report about the Foxes, and Rahm Emanuel has appointed a fox to oversee the Foxes that were terrorizing the chickens. So let's see what actually happens.
That was an incredible analogy. You know, but I got you. Right. David,
no,
go ahead.
I see the analogy, right? You have the fox on the hen house or the wolf, you know, wolf to catch a wolf or whatever, but it's not a laughing matter, but I do take Ralph's point, right? What happens next after the report, Wilmer? I think the recommendations are good. I think it's good that the report is out there and these issues are on the table. When you see a stat that people, I think, had a sense of this, but now you've got the numbers in front of you. Mm-hmm. In a city that's roughly a third African American, that roughly three quarters of the police killings and police woundings or injurings of citizens are toward African-American citizens. There's clearly an imbalance in policing, and clearly needs to be some redirect of the way police approach the African-American community. My thing, as always, is going back to this idea of, look, at the core of this, to me, is not so much those specific bullet points as much as police have to understand. Police have a tough job. It always bears repeating. They have a dangerous job. Mm-hmm. And you have to have police. But we have to get back to this idea in our cities that police serve the public. The public is not there to conform to the police. The police are there as public servants who are paid by taxpayers, who do a difficult and dangerous job, but they work for we the people, yes. Not the other way around.
Look, I looked at the report and I've looked at some of the articles that have been written about it, and you know, my first reaction is, all you've done is confirm something that most of us already knew.
So the response is, duh.
Exactly. I mean, the report seems to me, I am glad that the report was done. I understand that police have a very difficult job. I am hoping that what will happen is that people who will say, typically, it's your fault. The statistics are this high because it's black-on-black crime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm hoping those people will look at the report and begin to understand that there is a problem within the culture. You know, Rahm Emanuel, I believe, was, you know, sort of quoted as saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, the report is a report, but we already know racism exists in the country. And the question is, how are we going to deal with it? So, you know, from my perspective, it's another report. More recommendations. Is anything going to change? Hopefully, when you have an independent police review board that was criticized in here for basically getting complaints and doing absolutely nothing about it, how do you give the public any sense that the replacement, if it's a civilian review board, which I think is what is being recommended, is going to be any different?
Well, and there are a couple of things. I did not get through the entire report, but I did not see any mention of Holman Square, the black site in Chicago where police for years have been taking people off the books and torturing them. Mm-hmm. I saw nothing about that. No one has been fired as a result of this. Names weren't really mentioned, and because there are people in charge, and the people in charge have either been setting a tone or have been following a tone. And finally, Chicago doesn't exist in a vacuum. So New York and Stop and Frisk, for example, is part of a national systemic problem that fixing Chicago, if in fact that could happen, is not going to fix the problem.
You know, I think I believe that the hope is that the person that Rahm Emanuel has selected to become the new quote unquote permanent police chief is a person who, at least from what I've read, is a person who grew up in public housing, and I'm assuming that the belief is that he will be more sensitive to the concerns of the African American community.
Does Rahm Emanuel need to go?
go ahead,
that's
Rahm.
It. But also, you know, Rahm Emanuel purposely buried the police report on the killing of that young man.
The video.
Laquan simply
McDonald.
So
yeah.
that he could get reelected.
Right.
And now he unilaterally selected the next chief of police. That chief of police is now beholden not to the citizens, not to the committee, not to the council, but to the mayor who gave him the job. So I have no confidence that anything's going to change.
David?
Well, there's potential for things to change, and but I don't have a whole lot of confidence either. Here's something. When you look at the last election, the district attorney, Anita Alvarez, she was voted out, and one of the key issues where she lost the confidence of the public was this idea that in the Laquan McDonald case, in a video that law enforcement had for months and didn't release it, there was not this recognition in the part of leadership that they had to be forthcoming and transparent and accountable towards folks.
Another story making headlines this morning is Senator Bernie Sanders scheduled to speak at the 25th annual National Action Network Conference. Well, he is scheduled to speak at the 25th annual National Action Network Conference in New York City. This comes just one day after former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke at the conference. But before she got up to speak, Armstrong Williams, Dr. Ben Carson's business manager, warned the crowd about falling for fluff. Here's a recap of their comments from last night.
As I have said many times, white Americans need to do a much better job of listening when African Americans talk about the seen and unseen barriers you face every day. We need to recognize our privilege and practice humility rather than assume our experiences are everyone else's experiences.
We sit here, you hear the race speeches because they feel that's what you want to hear today. Everything in America is not always about race.
We have to demonstrate a sustained commitment to building opportunity, creating prosperity, and righting wrongs, not just every 2 or 4 years, not just when the cameras are on and people are watching, but every single day. I have worked on these causes all my adult life. I'm going to keep going at it no matter what.
Make these people earn your vote. If it's Donald Trump, so be it. If it's Bernie Sanders, so be it. Do not allow the Clintons and the establishment to waltz in here and wave their hand and everything is okay. Let them earn your vote.
I'm going to do everything I can to take on the gun lobby and to try to save lives, the lives of the children of women like this and the sisters and the brothers and the daughters and the sons of so many others. And I will work as hard as I can as your president to keep faith with them for police reform and demanding a criminal justice system that actually delivers justice.
I don't mind the hisses because you know the truth when you hear it. Make them earn your vote. If you talk about race, they play the race card too, as they did in South Carolina against Barack Obama. Don't get caught up in the short memory. This is a business. They'll say whatever they need to say and do whatever they need to do to get elected.
If we're going to ask African Americans to vote for us, we cannot take you or your vote for granted. We can't just show up at election time and say the right things and think that's enough. We can't start building relationships a few weeks before a vote.
So there are a few questions I'd like to discuss with the panel. First, do you think Secretary Clinton's message is all talk, or is she really here to assist African Americans? And also, do you think that Armstrong Williams made a valid point?
I have to tell you, I completely agree with everything Armstrong Williams said, at least in the clips that we saw. I didn't see the entire speech, so let me just say, in the clips that were just played, And increasingly, you are seeing more and more African Americans come to the conclusion that Republicans and Democrats alike take the issues of the African American community and just sort of poo-poo them. They know, Democrats know that they need our vote, but they also know the Democrat that many African Americans aren't going to vote anywhere else, so your vote can be taken for granted. A lot of Republicans will say, we can't get the black vote, so why even bother? Force people to give you a reason to vote for them. I think it's critical. And with the Clintons, I thought her speech was good. Mm-hmm. I believe the comments that she made. I am of the belief that it has been all talk from Democratic leaders for many years. And what we have seen is that the plight of the African-American community has not changed.
David?
Yeah, so full disclosure first. I know Armstrong. I've been on Armstrong's show. I think we all know Armstrong.
Yes.
Look. He has a point. I agree with Michelle that at a minimum, all politicians in both parties should work hard for the African-American vote, not take the African-American vote for granted. That being said, I think he's arguing from a position of weakness because his critique is a critique of Democrats when Democrats are working, I would say, considerably harder for the African-American vote right now than Republicans, and Armstrong is a Republican. It's fair to say, look, the Clintons in the past have been inconsistent on race issues. There's been a lot of controversy about the 94 crime bill. There, in 2008, there were allegations that they were playing the race card against President Obama, and I think in some cases they did, whether it was, even if it was sort of subtle, they played the race card. But
and
right
continued
now,
to play it throughout his administration.
But right there, Secretary Clinton is giving a speech trying to earn the African-American vote in front of an African-American leadership group, and he's saying they have to win your vote, and she's sitting there trying to win the vote.
Well, and remember, in terms of his credibility, Ben Carson, I can't say, worked actively to get the African-American vote. I mean, he came up with some sort of rap.
Ben Carson worked actively to not get the African-American vote.
Here's the thing that has to be realized about Armstrong's point. I think Armstrong made the right point, but his math was bad. This is why you have to show your work when you do math exams, because his standard line is, race has nothing to do with this. And here's some data on some relevant issues that are impacting the African-American community. When we look at wealth accumulation, when we look at unemployment, when we look at education, when we look at health care, all of these things, when you look at, for example, the average amount of white wealth is about $134,000 in a family. It's about $7,500 in the African-American family. Wait a minute. When you look at the wealth accumulation numbers on the screen there. You can look at education attainment. And when you look at education attainment, just in terms of bachelor degree, the unemployment rate nationwide, 5% African Americans is stated at 9. We know it's higher than that. Bachelor's degree, 72.9%. African Americans, about 10.3%. All of these things are relevant political issues, and race, it's not an accident that we are disproportionately impacted by all of these issues. Armstrong, on that point, is dead wrong.
But Armstrong didn't say that race is never an issue. Armstrong said that race is not always the issue, and that's the important point, because not in every situation
race
is not always the issue.
Race as the factor in terms of the solution. That was Armstrong basically setting it up so you could make that statement.
The statement I just made is factual.
No, but
race is not always the issue.
Education.
It is the issue.
Unemployment.
Sometimes, but not always.
Health care. Wealth disparity. Look at what's happening in Chicago. Police shootings. We have to go long way down the list before we get to a point where we are not disproportionately impacted by these issues.
Real quick, Michelle. Yeah. Ralph, I agree. Race is not always the issue, but that was not what I took away from what Armstrong said right there. He said race is not the issue here. But then he went on to talk about race. Yeah, sorry, Michelle.
But let's get back to Secretary Clinton. You know, she shows up. She shows up at a black church. So all of a sudden, she adopts a black dialect. I don't feel no ways tired.
President Obama did the same thing.
Well, exactly. And that's complete pandering to the black community.
But you know what?
The
fault for this, and we got to move on, the fault for this to me really comes down to the CBC and the fact, and the CBC PAC, and the fact that they have not forced Hillary Clinton to commit to any tangible, workable solutions or policies before they gave her the endorsement. There's still plenty of news, one now, coming up. North Carolina's bathroom bill is drawing backlash from all over the country. Will the governor's executive order stop the critics? We'll hear from the NAACP president of North Carolina next. Cedric the Entertainer talks about what he is doing to shed light on diabetic nerve pain. It's 17 past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
The Texas jail where Sandra Bland died needs a major overhaul, according to an independent panel tasked with looking into her death. The findings say that the Waller County Jail staff persistently dehumanized inmates. Recommended changes include better mental health screenings for inmates, body cameras and anger management training for jailers, and a new building. Bland was found hanged in her cell in July, 3 days after being arrested near Houston for minor traffic violations. Her death caused a national outcry after a grand jury decided not to indict anyone in her case. Waller County Sheriff Glenn Smith said, "Many of the recommendations in the report are doable, and staff de-escalation training will start in June." We're going back to the panel. Ralph Chittums of the Republican Party, Michelle Bernard, political analyst and attorney with the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy, and David Swerdlick, assistant editor at The Washington Post. This, to me, sounds an awful lot like the Chicago report just moved to another state.
I could barely watch just the clip that we just took a look at and look at her face. It is one report after another, and the country needs to be outraged. There is no way that we can continue to look at death after death after death and people not have a sense that the African American community is under attack. No one wants to confront the issue. Whites get so angry when you say that there appears to be a war on black boys and black men, that there is a war on African American women, but it looks to me like we are slaughtered. And a report comes out, and everything is supposed to be better. Nothing's changing.
No, David? Agree. I agree.
Yeah. Ralph?
I do agree. I mean, when people die in police custody, there has to be an investigation. There has to be. There's no reason for someone to just be picked up for a minor traffic violation, and then within a day or two, they're dead in a cell, and there's no investigation, there's no accountability.
What I find
interesting here is it says in the report, the findings say that the Waller County Jail staff persistently dehumanized inmates. When you talk about dehumanizing inmates, that has nothing to do with a new building. That has very little to do with anger management. To me, we're talking about a problem that as Africans in America and now African Americans, we have been battling since we got here in 1619, and that is to be considered human beings. How does a report change that type of misperception?
It can't. I mean, the culture has to fundamentally change. And with regard to the criminal justice system, I question whether or not the culture can change until we start not only investigating police misconduct. And again, with the caveat being, police work is so difficult. But when there are misdoings, there needs to be an investigation and people need to be arrested and imprisoned.
I mean, I have family members and friends in law enforcement mm-hmm. from here to California, across the country, and I can say with 100% certainty that most law enforcement officers are good.
Yes.
They get up every morning, they put on that uniform, the badge, the gun, and when they kiss their wife or husband and go walk out the door, everyone understands there's a good chance that they may not come home that night.
That is true.
But that doesn't change the fact that when one of these law enforcement officers crosses the line and does something wrong, that officer needs to be held accountable. But I would just caution everyone not to just throw a blanket indictment across all law enforcement officers.
And no one is doing that, and this report isn't doing that, but there are too many innocent people being shot down in the street, and it's been going on for far too long. And the major thing, I think, that has really brought all this to the forefront is video.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Here's another story I want to talk about. Take a listen.
I've listened to the people of North Carolina, and the people of North Carolina are entitled to both privacy and equality. We can and we must achieve both of these goals.
In response to the backlash over North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill, Governor Pat McCrory has signed an executive order as a sort of peacemaker. Under the executive order, restrictions on which bathrooms transgender people use will remain, but employment protections are expanded based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The change comes after public corporations and celebrities criticized the original law. But many say the change is not enough. The American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina says the discrimination against LGBT individuals remains and says the lawsuit against the state will proceed. In Mississippi, lawmakers are calling for the repeal of a new law that will let workers use their religious beliefs to deny services to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. The lawmakers hope to undo the measure before it becomes law July 1st. But supporters of both laws say leaders shouldn't cave to the public backlash.
Eventually it's coming here. It's not a question of whether or not it's going to be an issue here. It will be. And if evangelicals in the state of South Carolina don't start getting together, putting something together, trying to combat this. This is what we're going to have to contend, and it's not going to stop.
And still with me on the panel, Ralph Chittums, Michelle Bernard, and David Swerdlick. What are your thoughts? Let's first start with the North Carolina bathroom bill.
Well, I look at it this way. I'm a father of four. My wife and I, we have four children, mm-hmm. two sons and two daughters. If I walked around my house butterball naked with my genitals exposed to my daughters and someone outside my home found out about it, they would make a call to Child and Family Services and I would be investigated for child abuse. How then can someone go into a public shower, swimming pool locker room as a man and fully disrobe in front of female, in front of girls, and that be okay, but if I were to do something similar inside of my own home, I would lose my children and be charged with child abuse. So I have no problem with the, with this bathroom bill. If you, now, for the, now, I'm assuming, Michelle, that you're a woman. And
well,
I'm assuming
you.
That, you know, you two gentlemen are men,
safe
but
aside.
I don't know what's under your clothing. Now, if you walk into the ladies' room, that's fine because that's how you present. If you happen not to be a woman and you have male parts under those clothing, if you keep your mouth shut and go into the ladies' room, who's going to know?
Look, I think I don't understand your point.
The point if you are a transgendered person and you present as the opposite gender,
yeah.
if you keep your mouth shut, go do what you're going to do,
oh, okay.
and,
well,
and don't try to make a political point
and,
about
and
it.
And to Ralph's point, before we go to Michelle, there is, to my knowledge, no data to demonstrate that this is a problem.
That's exactly what I was going to comment on. It is, to me, the state should be embarrassed. And it will have a negative impact on the state in every area that you can possibly imagine, and it should. It is discriminatory, it is absolutely insane and ridiculous, and the fact, whether if somebody is a member of the LGBT community, that does not automatically mean that that person is somehow a threat to you, physically or in any other way. Just like a black man walking into a room is not a threat to people simply because he's black. I think it's the height of hypocrisy.
Quickly, David.
So since we talked about that part of the law, let me talk about the less talked about part of the law, which is that the state government passed part of the law saying that local governments can't pass more tolerant laws and more stringent anti-discrimination laws, which is strange coming from conservatives who usually say the government that's closest to the people is best. But if my hometown, Chapel Hill, wants to pass a law that's a tighter anti-discrimination law, they now can't under this law, which I think is a failure on the part of the Republicans.
In terms of Mississippi and this so-called religious freedom law, it is nothing but utter foolishness. If you, in order to do business, have to get a license from the state to conduct that business, then your religious issues, preferences, or proclivities are secondary. No one should be able to use their religious base as a means of discrimination for any reason at all.
Can I just raise a point?
I think we all agree that if someone is, you know, homosexual goes into a bakery and wants to buy a cupcake.
This sounds like a bad joke.
Right, but there is no legitimate reason that that store owner should not sell that cupcake to that person. Now, the difference is if that same person comes in and says, I want you to participate in my wedding, and that is a religiously held position that I don't agree
when
with that.
You have
you
to get a license from the state
participate
to do business. You do business.
Look, I want to just. Business.
It's you condoning
do
the ceremony.
Business.
And you do not, you should not be forced
now,
to do that.
The point I want to raise, which is tangential but important, mm-hmm. is that in most of the stories that we read about or we hear about where these types of things are happening are in the South. They are in states that are no longer covered under part of the Voting Rights Act that was struck down by the United States Supreme Court. And it is another reason that every American should be very, very vigilant
Absolutely.
In figuring out who they are going to vote for the presidency of the United States, because the next person on the Supreme Court will be making decisions about these very issues. And if the voting right part of the Voting Rights Act has already been stripped away and states that were covered in the South under the act are no longer covered, it could be a free-for-all on individual liberty and individual rights.
Now, Ralph, to your point, if you go into a bakery and you want that bakery to cater your wedding and you're gay, and that individual tells you, I'm not really comfortable doing this, and you still try to do business with that person, then you're a fool. You're just an utter fool. Yeah. And I don't have any problem with the baker saying, you know, your sexual preference is not, I'm not really comfortable with that, and I'll do it, but I really rather not. That to me is fine. But I say again, if you have to get a license from the state to do business, then you have to do business with everybody in the state.
Well, there's an issue of state licensure. I think that's an interesting point on the issue, Wilmer, as well. Ralph and I were talking about this a little before the show. I think the problem with, we have religious freedom in this country, clearly. But the problem with the religious freedom argument that's being made by proponents of these laws, like the Mississippi law, is that it's not clear to me at all that when someone comes to a cake maker and says, I want you to make the cake for my wedding, or a photographer for my wedding, and maybe they're a heterosexual couple, but maybe they had premarital sex, they're not being shut out, even though that's not Christian. There's a double standard at play here that I think is hard for them.
Great point. I got to stop you there. Yeah. Coming up, actor Wendell Pierce shares how he channeled Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas past to portray him in the upcoming HBO film Confirmation. It's 32 after the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Recently, Roland sat down with gospel artist Jonathan Nelson to talk about his new album, Fearless. Take a look.
About to experience a life-changing moment. You won't leave the same way you came, 'cause he's in our very midst.
Folks, you're listening to the song Anything Can Happen by Stellar Award winner Jonathan Nelson. He is illuminating the gospel world not only with his music, but by also writing songs for the likes of Bishop T.D. Jakes, Don Lawrence, J.J. Harrison, and many others. He is here to talk about his new album, Fearless. Fearless. Yeah. Jonathan Nelson, welcome to News One Now TV One. How you doing, man?
Man, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. Glad to have you here. And so when you came in here, you said that you used to be the minister of music at Empowerment Temple with Pastor Jamal Bryant.
Absolutely. I'm a Baltimore kid.
My apologies. You had to work with that fool.
Yes, but, I think you would say that.
Yes, yeah. because I tolerate Kappas.
I had to shout him out.
I got you. So this is your fifth album?
This is my fifth album, yes, sir.
All right, then. So why call it Fearless?
Because after my last CD was called Finish Strong, and the lyrics said, I'm going to have a strong finish because I have strong faith. And if you keep declaring over and over and over that you have strong faith, faith and fear, as we learn in church, can't reside in the same place at the same time. So I'm just letting everybody know my life. I'm going to take the risk in everything that I do, and I'm going to be fearless. And I want people to take that challenge as well. Be fearless. Whatever God or whatever your dream is, go after it. Take the risk. Take the jump. Take the leap, and then go after it, and don't look back.
When you're going through this process, and I interview many singers and songwriters, mm-hmm. How do you reach a point in terms of the project? Is it where you are in your life? Is it something different? So how do you say, okay, fine, this is what I want to be, this is what I want to sound like?
Okay, so two ways to answer. My daddy's a preacher. And so it's kind of like finding a sermon on a Sunday morning. I think he listens to what God is speaking in whatever season the church world is in. Mm-hmm. And I think also it's just if he encountered someone in the hospital that particular week and he's like, okay, I need to speak towards healing. That's the same with me. So I'm engaging in my life's experience, but where I feel like the culture is, and speaking to the millennials, speaking to the seasoned citizens. And I feel like this is what I'm supposed to say in this season. reason. And so when I'm creating music, I'm thinking about, you know, what is happening in our culture? What has happened? How can I affect that? How can I affect change in the church? And for those that may not be a believer, as we call it, how can I cause them to come to know Jesus?
You got some pretty good contributors here. Ty Tribbett, also Kim Burrell, Dorinda Clark Cole. And so some pretty interesting folks there.
Yes, sir. So Ty and I, we grew up together as children, and we have never done any work together on on wax, as they call it. So I said, hey, yo, Ty, we got to do something together. And so we did this song called I Give You Glory. I revered and respected the Clark sisters, Dorinda Clark Cole and Kim Burrell, for many, many years. And we have friendship, relationship. And I just felt like I needed to seal the deal with this. I needed to make some noise, but I needed to seal the deal. Hey, I'm calling on my relationships. We've done different things together, but we've never put anything on a CD. So, hey, God gave me these songs. And I, as I was writing a song, the song that Dorinda's on is called Forever Settled. Mm-hmm. It's based off their scripture in Psalms 119:89. It says, thy word, O Lord, is forever settled in heaven. And I could hear the vamp kind of trailblazing in my head. And I just heard Dorinda's voice singing it. And then I woke up one morning in December, around Christmas time, and the song is called Brand New with Kim Burrell on it. I heard the lyric and I heard it in the style of the way Kim Burrell would sing. Mm-hmm. So I literally, as I was getting dressed, I called and said, Kim, I got this song. I got this song. And I don't know anybody else that can deliver it but you. And so she said, look, Johnny, put me on a record. I'm coming. And so it's a done deal. There it is.
So I do this all the time when singers come on a show with their new albums. So let's go through his. You talked about Fearless. Uh-huh. What is My Hope about?
My hope is about re-engaging God every day. It says, God, you are my hope all day long. The lyric says, I'm not afraid because you are with me. And there are some people that are walking through life in a schizophrenic kind of state. And I think sometimes they forget to engage and talk to God. So that song is an up-tempo song, but it's saying, God, you are my hope all day long, every day. All day long.
Name of the Lord.
The name of the Lord. You know, the Bible says the name of the Lord is the strong tower, the righteous running and they are safe. And so every time we say, you know, the name of the Lord, we expect something to happen. So, you know, in church, they say, when you call on the name of Jesus, demons tremble, of which I believe. And so that song is just to get people to start calling his name, engaging a relationship with Christ.
Anything Can Happen.
Anything Can Happen is the single. It's one of my favorite songs. It is a song of inspiration, a song of encouragement, a song of hope, saying whatever my situation is, wherever my here is, anything can happen wherever my here is.
All right, then. Let's see. Brand New.
Brand New. Kim Burrell. The lyric says, God has made me brand new. In other words, we arise every day with new mercies, new grace every single day. So whatever happened yesterday, don't worry about it. Forget about it. Let's work with today. And God has made this day brand new. You can start new goals. You know, you can finish those goals in that particular day. Don't worry about tomorrow, but let's take care of today.
Amazing Love.
Amazing Love. My niece is actually singing that. She was 16 when we recorded it.
Jade Nelson.
Yes. All right. And this song is just talking about God's love. You know, and in creating this, I try to make sure that the message of Fearless is all the way through. Mm-hmm. And the Bible says that perfect love casts out all fear. And so when we talk about amazing love, if you have God's love, you have everything that you need.
I skipped a couple of songs, but we're going to end with this one. I Give You Glory.
I Give You Glory. That's, I grew up Pentecostal. So it's a hand clapping, foot stomping kind of church. It's my dad's church. And so I wanted to kind of celebrate what my father taught me in church. And so this song, we are leaving with celebration. How can you have all of these messages and not end with the celebration? So when we say, I give you glory, I give you praise because the enemy did not triumph. That means I am victorious in every area of my life.
Okay. I was going to say that was the last one, but I'll make this the last one. I believe Island Medley.
Let me tell you something. This song is, it is like creating its own thing on the internet and it's going crazy. I believe it's saying, you are the God of miracles, you are the God of wonders. But it's another segment that says, so long, bye-bye, goodbye to my troubles, goodbye to my pain. And so you got to dance while you're singing it and be encouraged.
Folks, the CD is called Fearless by Jonathan Nelson. The song that you're listening to is called Anything Can Happen. Jonathan, we appreciate it, man. Thanks a bunch.
Man, I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much.
All right, good luck.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate
we'll be back. News One Now on TV One.
On a News One Now primetime special, Kerry Washington talks to Roland Martin about her new role as Anita Hill in HBO's film Confirmation. Don't miss a News One Now primetime special, Kerry Washington Revealed, Sunday night at 10 on TV One.
In part one of Roland's sit-down with award-winning actor Wendell Pierce, the two chatted about Pierce playing the role of Justice Clarence Thomas in the new HBO movie, Confirmation. In part two of their one-on-one, Roland and Wendell dive into Thomas's political legacy and how his past ties into his present stance on social, civil, and political issues.
It's a story true.
I deny every allegation against me today that suggested that I, in any way, ever harassed Anita Hill. This is a circus, a national disgrace. And from my standpoint, it's a high-tech lynching.
He talked about this enigma. Here's where I believe it changed. When he went from Holy Cross mm-hmm. to Yale.
Right.
And so he comes to Yale, and I just think that here's a guy who was so bothered, and I call this white validation. He was so bothered that there were these white students who didn't believe that he belonged there.
Right.
That for a guy who gravitated towards the Black Panthers,
mm-hmm.
for that, oh my goodness, they don't think I'm good enough to be here. And that just sort of seeped into his consciousness and said, and everything I've read, that's why he's against affirmative action, because of what others think. And my position is, yeah. bro, that's self-esteem.
Right.
I don't give a damn what somebody else thinks.
And that is what I've received also. To focus on his self-esteem is what I tried to focus on, because he got that from both sides. You know, when he was in seminary school and high school, and also leads to the gender issues too, which helped me try to plot that path, because here, you know, not socializing with any women in the developmental years, because you're at seminary school with all men, all boys, all white, who are giving you hell. And then in his community, being perceived as Geechee and country, I met someone who knew him, who he said he hated to be called Clarence. He said, that's two syllables to my name. Clarence, not Clarence. He hated that.
Wow.
Young boy. And that really just opened up a lot. So that transition that you're talking about, that he was so defensive of, how dare you say I'm not worthy because of affirmative action, that when he went back to Savannah to be a lawyer, and he walked into those old school, old, you know, world law firms, and when he was denied employment there, he saw it as, oh, they didn't see my diploma as valuable enough. When it was so clear to me, that it was like, no, you could have come there with, you know, summa cum laude.
Right.
They would have never hired you.
Because you're a black man.
You're a black man.
And that's why later on, when he said his Yale degree is in his basement, it's worthless, it's irrelevant, it might be in a corner, I just think that here's a guy who felt that even that Yale validates me. And so, oh, I got it. And they still are blowing me off. So Yale is meaningless.
And then also,
Right.
He can't see. And it's almost a fervent belief in justice and equality that you don't want to accept the certain innately ugly things of human nature when it comes to racism. It's kind of like, no, I want to cross my T's and dot my I's to the point that I believe that everyone is fair and everyone is equal.
So if I work hard,
right.
I got my suit, I talk right, act right, do everything right, that's going to overcome
right.
anything.
It's the pain of realizing that the world is not meritocracy. You know, that you will not be, you're not always rewarded for the merit that you so rightly have earned and deserve. I think personally, for me to play the man, whether he accepts that or not, that gave me a well of emotion to dig into. Also, I add class to it. It's a colleague of Eric Holder, you know? They were, you know, in those same circles.
Right.
And, you know, there was someone in my research and interviews and all said, you know, Eric Holder was the golden boy going all the way back, you know? And I chose, whether this is truthful or not, to add that element, especially with so many African Americans in the story of this confirmation hearing and who was on what side and the mm-hmm. other. There was a little defensiveness when it came to class, you know.
Mm.
I'm from Pinpoint, Georgia. I'm this poor,
I'm dark-skinned, he's light-skinned.
Yeah, he's got, you know, he's the golden boy. He's going to go I don't know why I chose Eric Holder, but when I found out that they were around the same, the colleagues and around the same community, and someone mentioned to me, like, we all knew Eric was going places, you know? And I was like, wow, what if? And I don't know, that's speculative, and so that's just something fuel to add to my fire.
What do you make of, and I will never forget it, I will never forget being a student at Texas A&M and watching those hearings and listening to black folks say, you know, a brother got to do what a brother got to do. But when he gets on that court, then he's going to be free to be a black man.
No.
And then he gets on the court and makes these rulings, and black folks go, dude, what happened? It's a lifetime appointment. You don't have to please white folks now. And he's, no, that's who I am.
Yeah. I go to that one belief, and he actually used it in a dissension just recently with the same-sex marriage, you know, because that case was saying the government is denying me my dignity because I'm not allowed to marry the person I love. That was the basis of that case. And, you know, his dissension was the government cannot deny you your dignity.
You have it yourself.
It is self-endowed. And he purposely used slavery and the internments. Said, you know, the government never denied African Americans their dignity, even with the centuries of slavery. They never denied Japanese Americans their dignity.
Meaning, even if you are in the grips of slavery,
right,
you're not going to take my dignity.
And that's what he so fervently believes. My answer to that is, they did some damage to it, you know?
Yes.
You cannot
to dignity,
put a human
to self-esteem, to
character,
all of that.
To self-worth. You cannot be a student of psychology even and not think that those abhorrent, violent, murderous, rapist conditions won't have an impact on who the human being is. Your humanity, and they have to be held accountable for the damage that they've done to your humanity. But he believes in the straight lace. Now, at the same time, polar opposites went politically, but he also gave me a point of view that I hadn't even perceived before. Gun rights activist, you know, fervent believer in the Second Amendment that he is. He reminded me in his writings, his fervent support of the Second Amendment is because the first gun control laws were in the South after slavery to make sure black folks didn't get guns. As I was doing research for this role to play Clarence Thomas, and I came to that realization where he actually kind of pulled me to his side a little bit, it made me think about, I put out a tweet saying, you know, if every black male 18 to 35 join the NRA, we'll have gun control overnight.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wendell Pierce, always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Confirmation premieres on HBO Saturday at 8 p.m. Roland also spent some time with Confirmation's leading lady, Kerry Washington. Be sure to tune into their one-on-one on News One Now premiere special, Kerry Washington Revealed, airing Sunday at 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on TV One.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Kobe Bryant has walked away from the game he loves so much. The five-time NBA champion played his final NBA game last night at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. It was a night to remember and a star-studded event. The Black Mamba scored 60 incredible points, dropped 60 on him last night. Also, as always, he carried a miserable Los Angeles Lakers team to an improbable comeback victory, with the final score of 101-96. Kobe came up with the fifth highest scoring game of his career, making him the oldest player to score 50 points in an NBA game. After it was all over, he expressed humble thanks to his fans and family for their loving support over two decades. The future NBA Hall of Famer says he wants to retire to spend more time with his family. Just up from the coast from the Staples Center, there was another major event happening in the NBA. The Golden State Warriors have done it. That's right. Stephen Curry led his team to a new NBA record of 73 victories in a regular season NBA game, beating the Memphis Grizzlies 104-125 at the Oracle Center. The Warriors broke the longtime NBA record held by Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. That record stood for the last 20 years. And we must mention, the Golden State Warriors head coach is Steve Kerr, a key member of the 1995-96 Chicago Bulls team. But it was a milestone of a night for Curry, who became the first player to make 400 three-pointers in a season. I almost couldn't figure that out. That's so phenomenal. By knocking down 10 from long range on the way to 46 points and 402 total threes. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon, and this is News One Now.
On a News One Now primetime special, Kerry Washington talks to Roland Martin about her new role as Anita Hill in HBO's film Confirmation. Don't miss a News One Now primetime special, Kerry Washington Revealed, Sunday night at 10 on TV One.